Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We made this.
Hey, sis.
What's in your face?
It's a moustache. I've been growing it all summer.
I forgot to tell you, I saw Maeve the other day.
I don't need to know what Maeve is doing anymore.
Here are the students currently attending what has been dubbed the sex school.
Oh. Good morning, Morden. How is everyone feeling today?
Really good.
I am your new head teacher.
Seems that there are some students here who get a kick out of giving us a bad name. It changes today.
Oh! What?
I think I'm ready to, you know, really.
Hello, and welcome to Scheduled Programming, the official TV podcast of the We Made This Podcast Network. I'm your host, Ian Buckley, and Scheduled Programming is a show which we take a closer glance at new television, examining all the good, the bad, and the ugly of the small screen. In this episode, I'm very excited to talk about Sex Education Season 3, and my guest to discuss it with me is Luke Winch. How you doing?
Good evening, Ian. Evening as we record this. I'm very well. How are you?
Doing great. What did you think of the season? Let's start off with a little overall impression of what we thought of the season. We'll keep this discussion spoiler-free for now, but then we'll get right into discussing the season as a whole. So if you had to give a quick rating, like a score out of 10, what would you give Season 3 of Sex Education?
I mean, for me, I think this is the strongest season of Sex Education. I think the writing is top-notch. We've had two seasons to really get to know and live with these characters, and it just makes easing into Season 3 so easy. And I like the way the writers have taken some of the characters into places where you wouldn't expect them to go. I think if I was to score this, I would give Season 3 an 8 out of 10. And there's a couple of things that I think knock it down a notch, which we can get into later on. But 8 out of 10, I think this is an incredibly strong season of Sex Education and a strong season of television. I think it deals with some really contemporary social and cultural issues that are being highlighted more in society, especially with younger people. And I think they've integrated that into the story with the characters exceptionally well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm right there with you. I'd probably give it maybe a 9 out of 10. I loved this season. It sort of goes into you already kind of answered my next question which was, you know, how it sort of stacked up compared to the first two. It sounds like this was your favorite of the three so far.
Yeah.
I think it probably was for me as well. Certainly, I think I liked it much better than season two. I liked season two fine, but I think I liked this season quite a bit more than that, at least as much as the first season. I really enjoyed it. I'd give it probably a 9 out of 10 for me.
It's interesting because the way I kind of looked at the series after watching it, I thought it was, for me, I found it almost worked as a three-act structure. So you had Act 1, which was kind of the three relationships. You had Otis and Ruby, Maeve and Isaac, and Eric and Adam. And then Act 2 is the French trip, which a lot of stuff happens in that one episode. And then Act 3 is literally the consequences of everything that happened after the French trip. So there's a nice three-act structure to this eight-episode TV series, and I really enjoyed that. I thought it was a really well-structured piece of television.
That's a great point about the structure there, that may be one of the things that I felt season two was lacking a little bit, although I will admit it was also a weird time in my life and everyone's life when I was watching it, so maybe my state of mind had something to do with why season two didn't resonate with me as strongly as season one, and certainly this season did. But yeah, that's a great point about the structure. You're right. I think you're spot on. So much of this season revolves around these central relationships, and we'll get into that as we talk about the season in depth. But I you're right. I think they do a really good job, as they always have done, of exploring these important contemporary issues that are, yes, they're affecting all of us, but they're especially affecting, you know, younger generations who are coming up and grappling with a lot of these issues around sex and sexuality. And the show has done and continues to do a really excellent job of being very empathetic and realistic in the ways that it has these conversations through these stories.
Absolutely.
So it sounds like this season definitely left you looking forward to season four. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely, yeah. And there are some revelations that happen in the last episode, which is making me very interested to see what happens in season four.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's possible that season four renewal hadn't been announced yet when this season dropped. So I can only imagine those of us who finished season three before the season four renewal announcement, how they must have felt. But it is coming back, so we can all kind of breathe a sigh of relief that there won't be these threads left on these threads left dangling. So yeah, I'm very much looking forward to season four as well. This show has always been such a joy to watch, and season three was no exception. One of the things too, we talked about the writing and how well structured it felt, but I really also want to call out like the music supervision on this show. Like the music on this show is fucking great.
Yeah,
several of these songs are still like in the heavy rotation on Spotify. You know, and I finished, you know, we finished the show like a week or two ago now. So it's great job with the music, acting, directing, writing. Everything really feels like it's firing on all cylinders during this season. So it's really got me excited to see what they do next.
Yeah, definitely. And I think another thing apart from the music as well that I find very fascinating is the aesthetics of Sex Education and this weird amalgamation of different eras that they've kind of smushed together in this. So you've got like, I mean, the school has a very John Hughes 1980s vibe, I think, to it. And then the vehicles, I mean, a lot of the cars that are used in Sex Education are models between the 1970s and 1990s. So you've got this kind of retro vibe going on with the models of the cars. You've got some old TV sets that aren't modern, but then you've got all the telephone, all the cell phones are very modern, and the way they present the text conversations in a very modern way. So there's a nice kind of mishmash amalgamation, and it all works so incredibly well, even though they are kind of cherry-picked from different eras.
That's a great call. Yeah, I hadn't picked that up about the models on the cars, but yeah, you're right. It does have this sort of 80s, 90s teen sex comedy language that it uses, but also has placed it thoroughly in 2021, in the kinds of conversations that they're having, the kinds of issues that they're bringing up in the specific details.
Yeah, definitely. I think the showrunner Laurie Nunn said the homage to John Hughes type of look the school was very deliberate, and it was something that they wanted to kind of pay homage to.
Great. Yeah, it definitely pays off. It definitely comes across. So yeah, I think that's where we'll leave it in terms of our spoiler-free conversation. So I think the rest of our conversation is going to presume that anyone listening has seen the episode, or seen the series rather. So if you haven't, go watch it. It's great. You won't regret it. And come back and listen to the rest of this conversation, because we're going to spoil everything, including some pretty big twists and turns along the way.
If you haven't watched it, why haven't you watched it yet? It's the question.
Exactly. How do you not know that this is going to be your jam?
Yeah.
Season three picks up kind of right where we left off with these characters. The sort of end of the previous school year and through the summer, we get this montage catch up with these characters in these new relationship configurations that they're in.
And that includes a, as we learn, a very secret relationship that Otis is in with Ruby, of all people, and also the very public relationship that he has with the awful mustache he's trying to grow.
Yeah, oh dear. I'm so glad that comes off later on, because it's so...
So glad it only survives, like, one episode. It's awful. It is the worst. But it's also perfect, because all of us went to school with someone who, or maybe even were that someone, who tried to pull that off, and it's never good. It's never a good idea. It's never a good look. It's never worked for anybody.
No, definitely not. And for someone like me, whose facial hair takes about 16 years to grow an inch, it's, you know, for a young school boy like that who wants to maybe emulate manhood in some way and tries to grow a mustache and just fails miserably, that's the kind of situation that Otis finds himself in there.
He's in this secret relationship with Ruby. What did you think of this relationship that he has with Ruby? Were you surprised, as I was right off the bat, that it was even a thing?
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I was absolutely surprised. I mean, because in season two, they had sex at the house party because they were both horrendously drunk.
Yeah.
And it ends up that they had sex, but that's as far as that went at that time. So to learn that they have continued this in a sober fashion, but in secret, is it was quite shocking. But it's something that over the course of three or four episodes, when they're in this relationship, it's actually one of the highlights of this season for me. I thought it was such a brilliant way of bringing Ruby to the forefront, who really has only been a slightly 2D character in the background. You know, she's been the school bitch, the fashionista, this top of the pecking order of students, and it's just really interesting that she's pursuing this kind of relationship, albeit casual sex at first, but doing it in secret. But it's very telling of her character that not everything is as it seems, and we discover that as we go along.
Yeah, she was kind of up until now this very easy to categorize character, sort of like you would see, sort of in the backgrounds, in the cast of characters in a John Hughes film. But now that we've got this larger canvas to paint on, we're able to actually paint in a lot of details on these side characters who we probably never really thought that much about and wouldn't if we were meeting them in the context of a two-hour film where we don't really get to know them very much. And really, in just a few scenes, in just a few episodes, they were able to give a lot more depth to this character, Ruby. And I really appreciated about this season and this series as a whole. I like the way that they're able to shift focus really quickly on these characters we didn't know much about. And with just a few scenes that are well-written and well-acted, we come away with a much different notion of who these people are.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the moment that this kind of mask came off of her was in, I think, episode 3, when they had the double date with Adam and Eric, and that wonderful, wonderful scene at the bowling alley, and Eric's trying to say, Adam, make sure you talk, and he comes out with does anyone smell their own farts? So it starts right. It sounds as though it's going to be an absolutely terrible evening, and then I think Adam says, have you watched the Kardashians? And immediately Ruby is able to interact with Adam, and never in a million years would you think the character of Ruby and Adam would interact together and have a conversation together.
Yeah.
And the way that the writers integrate this, and it ends up Ruby having a good time with a bunch of people and actually be herself with no pretense, without having to keep up this persona that she has to around school. And it's a really lovely scene. And I, and you know, and then that leads of course to her leads to Otis kind of badgering her to take him home with her, because she's been avoiding taking anyone home because of what her home life actually is.
Yeah, we learn that not even her friends, the clique that she is constantly with in school, none of them have even been to her house at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it's really refreshing to see a character that we've kind of pegged into this stereotype, and then for the writers to go, okay, we're going to flesh this character out and give you what she's really about. And the fact that she is having to care for her father pretty much full time, which is not school, and you see a much softer side of her, and because she opens up to Otis, it's just lovely to see firstly the actress to get some great material to use, and secondly to see Ruby allow herself to be herself. And I think on a macro level as well, this goes for a lot of the characters in this show.
Yeah,
that it's about being honest about yourself.
Yeah, and I think Adam says something, you know, insightful that nobody expects him to say during that scene when they're all hanging out together. So it's, you know, it's not even just them about him connecting on a sort of a pop cultural touchstone. He actually opens up a little bit, and the way that he subverts the audience's expectations, and indeed everyone else who's there, he subverts their expectations, is really heartwarming. And I love that about this show. I love that the ways that most of these characters subvert audience expectations, you know, is in a way that makes us feel good. Generally,
yeah.
You know, it might not always start out that way, but it ultimately gets there, because you're right, it's about these characters, you know, actualizing and being honest with themselves and others, and reaching their full potential.
And what's really interesting though about the characters of Ruby and Adam, who personally I think are the highlights of this season. I just think they're both the actor who plays Adam is just genius. The guy's brilliant. But what I found interesting about the characters of Ruby and Adam is that from a narrative point of view, they both open up to a certain person, or, you know, about themselves, and reveal their true selves to somebody, or they're honest with somebody. And narratively speaking, they're then punished because of that. And what I kind of mean by that is that, you know, Ruby opens up to Otis, and what happens is that when she says I love you, he doesn't reciprocate. He just says the worst thing you could possibly say, which is, that's nice. Which,
oh.
At that moment I sank into my sofa.
Oh,
I cringed so much.
God, that moment was, I could feel it physically. You can feel that physically when he says that. And it's just, you know, it boggles the mind. You know, someone who is otherwise so emotionally intelligent would that would come out of his mouth. Of all things, of all possible things, of all possible configurations of words in the English language, that's what he came up with. It was visceral, and it was
visceral,
and it, you know, it punches you in the gut. It almost was so out of sync with what I would have expected from him, that it almost pulled me out of it a little bit, because I was like, you can't possibly be this clueless to think that this, like, you have the entire array of words in front of you you could use, and this is what you chose. It probably did pull me out of it a little bit. It's just so effective, the cringe-inducing response that he has. It's just, it's devastating.
It is, and just a look on Ruby's face, and you know, I actually started to really root for Ruby and Otis. I thought they're actually making quite a cute couple.
Yeah,
you know, they're from very different backgrounds, but they're obviously enjoying each other's company. Unfortunately, Otis doesn't feel the same way that Ruby does, and maybe I don't know. Maybe Ruby doesn't really love him in the deep love sense, but I think because he's probably the first person she's opened up about her home life to.
Exactly.
I think that, you know, I think she feels so comfortable with him now. But I think saying I love you isn't really, I don't know, I don't think it's really the deep sense of love that you get. And they've not been together very long either.
Yeah.
But I think it's just the fact that she's the first person who's seen who she really is.
Right. Yeah, where Otis, you know, Otis, when he, on one of his attempts to explain himself, you know, he does point out at one point, like, we haven't really known each other for very long, and up until, like, very, very recently, their relationship, quote-unquote, was entirely sexual and pretty abusive on her end of him, at least, you know, in terms of their relationship dynamic. It only really, in the last couple of weeks, when she says that, by the time she says that, has become anything more. So I get why we would come away with the impression that, like, does she even really know? Does she know what that means? Does she mean this? Is she being honest with herself about how she feels? Is she capable of that yet? These are all interesting questions that I think the show leaves with us, and I think you're right. It's possible that his response to that is because he's not even, like, convinced that she even means it. But God, the response is just so ham-fisted. It's just so awful to listen to. When, like, I my entire body is cringing just thinking about that scene.
He could have said anything else.
Anything else would have been better.
Oh, dear.
But yeah, the show actually does, I think, a good job of that in a lot of ways, in providing these relationships that aren't, you know, maybe the relationship that we're supposed to be rooting for, we the audience are supposed to be rooting for, like Ruby and Otis, like, they're cute together. We see them interact in ways that, like, you know, we're rooting for them. They're in these scenes where we want these characters who aren't making a connection to be making more of a connection so that they can stop being in this painfully uncomfortable relationship that they're in at the beginning of the season. And so when they actually start to...
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Connect. The audience does too. And they do that, I think, with Maeve and Isaac as well. They get a pretty sympathetic character who, yes, at the end of season two, does a very unsympathetic thing in deleting that voicemail and in inserting himself into, you know, Maeve's relationship with Otis. And his motives were clearly not innocent. He was obviously interested in Maeve. So I thought the way that relationship played out was pretty interesting too. What did you think of their relationship in the season?
You know, Isaac was a character that I and many other people did have a preconceived opinion of him going into season three because of the event that you just described when he deleted the voicemail, which is a real shitty thing to do.
Yep.
So coming into season three, I wasn't warmed to Isaac at all. I thought he did a very selfish thing. But what the writers do again, and of course the actors, I think the actor who plays Isaac, George Robinson, is very, very good. And Emma Mackey, of course, is just astonishing. She's brilliant. So they managed to make me warm to him, and I actually start to feel sympathy for him. I start to appreciate him as a person, and he actually does. He truly, really, really likes me. And they both come from this background where, you know, they've both been orphaned in some way.
Yeah.
So they get to share that between themselves. So I did warm towards Isaac. And actually, when Maeve and him move into a more intimate and physical relationship, I thought that was handled really deftly, really delicately.
Such a touching scene, right?
Very touching. I thought it was actually quite moving and very refreshing.
Yes.
Because I don't think I've ever seen a disabled and non-disabled person on TV, young people on TV, in a TV show, have an intimate physical relationship on screen. And I found it really refreshing and very touching.
Yeah, and presented in the exact same way in terms of how it was shot and everything that you would shoot a love scene between two non-disabled persons. I thought that was
exactly,
really moving and effective. And another thing that the show does really well, like there are some of its messages of inclusivity that it hits the audiences over the head with, for better or worse, and that's great. I'm in favor of the show being as inclusive as it is, but it also is inclusive in these other more subtle ways that I really, really enjoy and respond to, and this was one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think because of their intimacy, then that then kind of moves Isaac to be honest with Maeve about deleting the voicemail. And again, we just get this, it happens in all three of these relationships, that it gets to a point and then some truth is said between them, and that truth then hurts the other person in some way. So, you know, you get Eric and Adam, which we'll discuss later, Otis and Ruby, Maeve and Isaac, they all reach a certain point and then the truth hurts, and it kind of it either ruins or disrupts the relationship. So I like the way that those three relationships mirror each other in that way.
Definitely. And Maeve and Isaac have I guess multiple revelations, because you know, he has that confession to her about the voicemail, and they, you know, they move past that, and it was necessary for that to come out, for them to move past that. And that's that sort of the gauntlet that they went through together, and they came out through that at the other side. And you're sort of thinking to yourselves, oh, well, maybe they're going to make it. And then of course the trip to France happens, and you know, in the fallout from Maeve and Otis kissing and her telling Isaac, it's that additional revelation, the ultimate truth that's hanging over their relationship and any potential relationship, is that Otis is really who she's the most in love with.
Yeah, it's funny, because even though Otis and Maeve don't actually share that many scenes this season, they are the axis of which the show revolves around. It's even though you've got this wonderful ensemble cast, those two are the axis, and everything kind of revolves and goes around them. So it's great that we get this middle point in France, and it is literally the middle of the season.
Yeah.
And we get this revealing of what the voicemail actually said and what it actually means to Maeve. The structure of this season, I think, is just sublime. I think it's very, very well thought out.
Yeah, and they ratchet up that tension between the two of them, of the, you know, we the audience have the perspective of knowing the situation. We know what happened. Mm. And so we're like, by the time they actually have the conversation, we're practically screaming at the two of them every time they're on the screen together, just talk, just fucking talk, just use the words and talk.
Yeah.
And then they do, and it comes to a head, and they kiss, and then there's the fallout from that, because Maeve and Isaac are together at that point, and I've forgotten if Otis and Ruby has he shot the bet on that already by that point, or is that yet?
Yeah, he has.
But that has just happened, and so they're both at this sort of this position in their lives where this kiss really can't, shouldn't, whatever, you know, happen, and it does. And then, yeah, you're right, it's this bright, shining midpoint in the middle of the season, where the rest of the season is all the fallout from this trip.
Yeah, I don't think it's any mistake that the shit hitting the window, as it does, is also the shit hitting the fan, because everything kind of just falls apart afterwards after that moment.
That was nothing if not a great metaphor on screen. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, Poogate was a hilarious. I mean, look, toilet humor's silly, but by God, that was funny.
Oh, but yeah, but it was done so well.
So well.
really nicely done. And of course, the I guess that's one of the other relationships that we'll discuss as we're talking about Adam and Eric, but Adam and Raheem's relationship as the season progressed has been, you know, was another thing that I found really compelling and interesting, and another thing that I'm going to be looking forward to in the next season.
Yes, absolutely. I found it very interesting, and they managed to make a lot of that from quite few scenes, really, as well. They had a few scenes on the coach in France, and then some short scenes at school, and you know, it's just this dislike they have for each other. I don't know. I think Raheem is slowly realizing that Adam is actually a very kind person, but intensely closed up and closed off. And I think a lot of that is due to his father's relationship, which we can get into later as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a very interesting evolution of that relationship. And now that Eric splits up with Adam, there is a very interesting through line now going with Raheem and Adam.
Yeah, that's kind of my expectation. I think that's sort of where the show is leading us, is that there may be something here potentially between Raheem and Eric. You know, Raheem is someone who, in terms of his speed, in terms of how he presents his sexuality and how he likes to be out and about in the world, seems like it might be on a closer frequency to what Adam's working with. You know, he's walking, right? And Eric is ready to fly. And that's fine. Adam has every right to take his personal growth at whatever speed he wants to take it. But, you know, I think ultimately that's tragically what led them to break up at the end of the season, is they're just in different places and they're just going in different directions at different speeds. It's a shame, but it's also very realistic. That is just a thing that happens in human relationships sometimes, and it's nobody's fault. It's just a thing that happens. And, you know, seeing the course of their relationship was definitely one of the highlights of this season for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting when you talk about Eric Adams' different places of where they are, how comfortable they are with their sexuality, and Eric is much more comfortable. He expresses himself through his loud clothing and his makeup. So he feels comfortable telling the world that he is gay, telling the world about his sexuality. Whereas Adam is nowhere near that yet, and Eric is seeing that as this hurdle, as this kind of barrier to who he wants to really be. And it is tragedy, because Adam and Eric are absolutely lovely together. And, you know, Adam's really come out of his father's shadow because of Eric. And Eric has helped him express himself the way he wants to be. And it's been a really touching relationship. So it is tragic. It is really sad when they split up. But I completely understand it from Eric's point of view, because he doesn't want to be held back anymore. He wants to go at the pace that he feels comfortable with, and unfortunately Adams is much slower than that. As you said, he's still walking, and Eric is ready to spread his wings.
One of the things that I loved that they did this season was they expanded on Adam's difficulties in communicating and his anxiety, his profound, really deep anxiety about, I mean, he can't face a person and say the words that are in his head. He gets too anxious about it. They don't come. I loved that we got further explanation and exploration of that this season. That is one of those things that it's easy to get so frustrated with Adam, especially in previous seasons. You know, he's so closed off. He just won't say the words that are clearly in his head and sometimes even written on his face. And the words don't come out of his mouth, and it's frustrating. But the show opens up our perspective to see that it might be frustrating for us, but it's hell for him. And he's the one who actually has to experience this inability, this frustration and anxiety. And so I love that exploration of that in the season. But yeah, you're talking about a guy who needs to look the other way, or it needs to have you look the other way in order to have like an open, honest conversation about something like, and Eric's like ready to like go to festivals and live out loud and be proud and do all this stuff. And Adam's just learning how to speak what's in his heart for the very first time. They're just in such different places.
What I've really, really found fascinating this season as well is the mirroring of Adam and his father, Mr. Groff, Michael Groff. Their story arcs this season have been incredibly interesting, and a lot of Adam's anxiety and his inability to express himself, to look people in the eye, stems from his abusive relationship with his father. And we learn this season that Mr. Groff himself came from an abusive household, that his father and his brother, played by Jason Isaacs, who's an absolute fucking dick.
So he plays such a great dick.
Oh, he does. He plays an absolute dick. But we see that a lot of Mr. Groff's warped view of what a man should be stems from his abuse. So it's this cycle of abuse that is quite commonplace among abused families. That, you know, it's this cycle of abuse from different generations. And what I love about Mr. Groff's short story arc in this is that when he stands up to his brother at the dinner party, and comes out of the shadow of his brother, who's bullied him and belittled him and demeaned him in public. Once he gets out of that, you see a completely different side of Mr. Groff. He's playful. He's lighter. He's more adventurous. He is more braver to try and fix things with his ex-wife. And this is exactly what happened with Adam when he found Eric. So I like these mirroring of how they've both been in an abusive father and son relationship, and they've both found ways of escaping that in some ways, but still, you know, they still have a lot of problems to tackle them with within themselves.
Yeah, and even tying back to Ruby's relationship with Otis, you know, when she finally opens up to him, she falls in love with him, or at least thinks she's doing that, because all of these feelings are now being felt for the first time. And that's definitely one of the themes that the show likes to explore and does so really effectively.
Definitely.
What did you think about, sort of related to Eric and Adam's relationship, but one of the inciting incidents that makes Eric realize that this might not be working out is he goes on a trip. Goes on a trip overseas to Nigeria, I believe. Or am I correct in that?
Yes, Nigeria. Yes,
okay. And we get a glimpse of what that is like for him. And we see sort of what tamped down Eric is like. And it's not great.
No.
We sort of get a sense that this is not this young man in his natural habitat, despite the fact that he is quote-unquote home in one sense. You know, he's welcomed by his loving grandmother, but he's not able to be honest and open with her about himself. And he's in a land that is his ancestral home, and, you know, folks look a little bit more like him, and they speak a little bit more like him, but he's also in a country where he could go to jail for being out and himself, and if not face imprisonment, face hostility and the threat of violence, which he faced a little bit, you know, even at home. It's not like he doesn't get bullied at the school some, you know, we see that in season one, but there's this level of fear that he doesn't have to have at home that he has, you know, when he's here. And we get a glimpse of the sort of underground nightlife, because it has to be underground there. And that's when he opens back up. He feels free again. He feels like he can express himself again. And he gives in. He kisses this man who's a local, who's his sort of guide to the nightlife. And you know, he doesn't really know this guy. It was a sort of dodgy situation getting him here to this club, and he just kind of gives in to the energy of the moment. He feels momentarily like he can be himself, and the minute he feels like he can be himself, he wants to explore. He wants to push the boundaries and express his sexuality openly, and that's just not where Adam is. And when he comes back, he's confronted with that again.
Yeah, I think Nigeria is the crux of Eric's decision to split with Adam because of what he experienced there. The Nigerian chapter, I think, works on many levels, because it works from a character level for Eric. A lot of what you've already said about, you know, he's going back to his ancestral home. He can't be open because of the religious persecution that he will get for being an openly gay man. I mean, it's there are many areas of Africa where it is actually you can actually be put to death for being gay. So it's a very dangerous place, and that's talked about quite a few times before he goes on the trip. So you get that cultural, social level of what it means to be a gay man in a completely different society and culture and country. And as you said, it's not perfect here either. He does get that hate crime in season one, but it's a lot safer than it is over there. And then you get, yeah, I mean, there is no excuse for Eric to kiss a man and cheat on Adam, but I understand that he gets caught up in the moment. He feels it, you know, within this underground club, he's with his people, he's with his tribe, please excuse the pun there, but he feels completely comfortable expressing himself the way he's wanting to. He's wanting to spread his wings, as we keep saying. So I understand why the situation happened. It probably shouldn't have happened in the first place. But what I find interesting also is I ask myself, you know, if Adam had gone to Nigeria with him, Adam would never have gone in that club, because he would not have felt comfortable with himself going in there. So there's lots of different questions that are raised in that scene, and lots of different commentaries that we can pull from that as well. So it's a really interesting moment in the season.
Yeah, and I think Eric comes back from that trip being confronted with the very difficult reality of being out in the daylight, as it were, in Nigerian society. And then he's introduced to this underground club, and he looks around and says, man, even here, where I can't go out in the street and be myself and be out and proud, there's still people willing to do this with me and have a good time and live their life in whatever way they can. And now I'm back in England, and we can go do this anywhere, and he won't do it with me. Mm. He's never going to do it with me. And this is the kind of life that I need to be living. And once he realizes that, it's over, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And also that, you know, the underground club also represents something else, which I think is an overarching theme of this season, which is individuality, uniqueness versus conformity and oppression. And mm-hmm. when you are in an oppressed society, there will always be underground movements. There will always be the rebellions going on underground in the background, because people will not be suppressed. They will want to express themselves the way they want to, even if they have to do it in secret. And what's lovely is that you can then lift that theme of uniqueness versus conformity and plump it down on Moreland School with the new headmistress and what they're trying to do with the pupils there. So I love the way they've kind of made that theme fit into those different storylines.
Absolutely, and I guess that can serve as a transition into, you know, we're introduced to we get a new head teacher played by Jemima Kirk, and she begins to make some changes to the school that the students don't love. At least most of them don't. And yeah, what did you think about this whole plot line? I love a good students rising up against, you know, the forces of conformity and oppression story myself. So what did you think of it?
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed. Well, I say enjoyed. I found it a very interesting
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Storyline, I found it very frustrating. I got angry because I don't like it when people are basically, you know, their ability to express themselves and be unique and not being allowed to do that, I find is a very oppressive, horrible thing to do. And, you know, it really affects some of the students. You've got poor Lily who loves to dress wacky and have this makeup, and she's basically told that she's not allowed to be like that. She's not allowed to express herself the way she is, and she has to put her hair down and have it a normal colour, and it's, you know, and she, I was worried for Lily actually, because she gets very depressed, very very dark and depressed.
Very depressed.
And I actually thought for a moment, I thought they were going to go quite dark with her character, but I'm quite glad they didn't, because I don't think Sex Education's ready to go to that place. But she does get very depressed, and she does get very down and inward on herself, and it's, you know, you could almost say it's abuse in some ways, that what Hope is doing and what she's implementing, and this draconian rule of law that she's saying that you can't have coloured hair, that you all have to wear the same uniform. It really is quite scary, I think. And, you know, in the UK, I don't want to get too political, but in the UK, the Conservative Party have been the governing body of the thing, and the state of our schools at the minute is somewhat questionable, and the way they're not, you know, that there is inclusivity problems, and this is highlighted when we're introduced to Cal and Layla, our non-binary students, and that I find really, you know, really interesting how they highlight that, and also again frustrating, and it makes me angry. You know, I'm well aware that I am a straight cis white male, and I can't put myself in their place, but what I can do is I can be outraged that these things are happening, and I am, and you know, I'm glad that this show is highlighting those issues that are quite obviously real issues in the real world, which is why they're putting them in this show.
Yeah, did you have a school uniform when you were school aged?
We did, yes. Yes, we had a school uniform until we got into sixth form, and then we could just wear what we like, you know, within reason, jeans and T-shirt. But whilst we were in years like one to six, yes, it was a school uniform.
There's not really, at least in public schooling here in the States, there's not really a culture of school uniforms. Mm. Again, for better or worse, a lot of people in this country very, very concerned with individuality and expressing themselves. That has its pluses and minuses. That usually is sort of the direction that at least the public schools I attended went, was sort of allowing for, there weren't that many restrictions on what you could and couldn't wear. They basically drew the line at written obscenity and, you know, you can't wear advertising for alcohol. And that's basically, even just seeing students like going to a high school in uniform was just, it felt so deeply wrong to me. It just felt alien. You know, there's plenty of private schools where that would be the expectation. But again, you know that you're getting that when you go there. You know what you're signing up for. Mm. It wouldn't be something that anyone here, I think, in the States would expect going to a regular regular public school at any age. But it was interesting to see. And yeah, I loved the introduction of Cal I know we didn't really get too much with Layla, the other kind of non-binary character, but even they got a really meaningful scene in I think it was the last episode with Cal, where they were struggling with their bindings, their chest bindings, and they went to Cal for some help, and they were able to bond over bindings, and it was a really moving sequence. Again, like a really short couple of scenes, but was immediately able to flesh out these characters in ways that I appreciated and that I hope carries through into season four as well. I liked the introduction of these new characters. I know Hope was a compelling villain, because I think she presented, certainly early on, having seen movies and shows like this, you know, I was immediately kind of a bit suspicious of her, as I think we were all kind of meant to be. But she does a good job of presenting this facade of, hey, I'm a hip teacher, I get it, you know, I want everyone to feel like they have a voice, I want everyone to be heard, I want everyone to be doing the things that they want to do to be the most successful versions of themselves. And then within a couple of episodes, it's just more rules, more regulations, more restrictions. You're a non-binary student. I don't know what that is. I don't want to deal with it. It sounds like nonsense to me. Go to the girls' locker room. I don't want to deal with it. You got a trans student. I don't even know what that means. I don't want to deal with it. Go to the girls' locker room. I don't care. Yeah. Pretty shortly established herself as a capital V villain, because I think in the ethos of this show, she represented, you know, everything that the show was against. And so I thought she was an effective foil for all the students, all the main characters in the show.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Layla may be more prominent in season four. I think that lovely scene between them is a kind of sign for what we're going to see from them in season four. And I think Layla particularly may come up to the forefront. You know, like they brought Ruby forward, like they brought all these characters that were kind of in the background for season one and two. It'll be fun to see these other characters come to the fore and have storylines for them. Hope's a great villain. And the one misstep, and this is my markdown, I think, the one misstep I think they didn't quite hit the mark with was the side plot with Hope about her her wanting in vitro. And this was... I think this was an attempt by the writers to make us sympathise with Hope a bit more. But the problem is, it comes so late in the season and she's been villainised so much that I personally couldn't sympathise with her, even though she's trying for a baby. They try and soften the character up a bit, but it just was too late for me and it didn't quite hit the mark, and I couldn't quite relate to that character and relate to her pressures, you know, the obvious pressures that she's facing from the school board, which is probably the reason why she's being so draconian about it. But because she was so villainized quite heavily through through episodes 1-4, 1-5, it didn't quite work for me.
Yeah, I hear that, and I tend to agree. I think that if anything, it seemed to exist for that last scene that she has with Otis, where, you know, he has this very mature, very Otis-like, as we've come to sort of expect from him, at least in the first couple of seasons. He's taken a bit of time off from doling out good advice. But here he has some for her, and his mother overhears it and gives him some words of encouragement about, you know, hey, if you want to pursue therapy as a life goal or as a career or whatever, I'll support you. And it feels like that was sort of the reason for that subplot. There wasn't much more. You're right, it was I think additionally meant to make us sympathize for her a little bit more, but you know, other people go through that without taking it out on other people in their life. I didn't really know if the show seems to have like fairly clear things to say, or at least a fairly clear point of view about a lot of what it presents to the audience. I'm not really sure what the show wanted us to feel about Hope at the end of the day. I mean, some sympathy, I guess, which she gets from Otis. I mean, it's a good scene, it's a good speech,
it is a good
scene. I agree with everything he says to her, but it did feel a little bit like that little side plot existed just for that scene and not really for anything else, because I don't think the show is trying to say that a woman in her position can't hack this kind of job. I definitely don't think the show is trying to say that. I don't think the show is trying to say that, you know, the pressures of trying to get pregnant can drive you nuts a little bit. Like, I don't think the show is trying to say any of those things. So I think it was just to give us a little bit more sympathy for her, to with a couple of scenes do what they've tried to do and have done more successfully with other characters, and give us a little bit more depth to Hope, in the hopes that the audience will not dislike her to the point where we don't even want Otis to have a conversation like this at the end with her. It does want us to have that level of sympathy for her, and it does want Otis to say what he says, and I'm glad he does, because I think it's worth hearing. But if that was the only reason for that subplot, I think you're right. I think it misses the mark a bit.
Yeah, you're right about that last scene. It is great between those two and Asa. Is it Asa Butterfield? I think that's his name. Asa Butterfield as yes. Otis. I mean, that kid is he's a talented actor, and he really knows how to, you know, deliver his lines, and it's a very mature scene for him. And I think he says at some point early on in the season that, you know, he's an older man stuck in a teenage body, an older mind as well, which is true to the extent that he can't reply anything apart from "that's nice" to "I love you." But apart from that, he has got some, you know, he's got some wise words to give, and it is a nice season. You know, with all that's gone on between Hope and the students, it's a nice kind of conciliatory conversation that they have.
It definitely is, and I think that calling back to that earlier conversation with him and Ruby, I think the reason why that moment almost kind of pulled me out of the episode when it happened was that Otis doesn't feel like the Otis that has this conversation with Hope at the end. It feels like this can't possibly be the same brain coming up with the same words. But, you know, we all have our off days and our off moments. Maybe Ruby just really caught him flat-footed and he just... his brain just imploded on itself, but man.
Yeah, the words "I love you" definitely have an adverse effect on Otis.
Clearly. The relationship we get with Lily and Olaf. What did you think of this one? We didn't spend as much time with it as we did these others, but we continue to learn more about these characters that we met in season two.
Yeah, I mean, the more I think about their relationship, actually, and I touched upon it earlier on when I said that, you know, when she's forced to take her makeup off and not express herself the way she really goes in within herself. And within their relationship with Ola, I think, you know, there's a problem that Ola has is that, you know, when they have sex, that she likes to dress up as an alien and role play with it. And I don't know, maybe it's almost that she's afraid to be herself with Ola or with anybody, really. And she uses this, you know, this alien persona, and she loves the stuff about corn circles and writing alien erotica and all this. And it's almost as though she uses that as a shield to protect herself from the world, to not let anyone in as much. So that's kind of what I got from their relationship, and, you know, the scenes that they have together and this kind of conversation that they have about having sex normally with each other and not the role play is what really starts to get between them and causes a rift. So yeah, I think Lily's got some issues to get through herself and to be honest with herself, really, about who she is. And maybe she's using, you know, she's using her alien erotica and her role play to hide her real self.
Or maybe she's just super into that stuff.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Just needs to have I shouldn't say needs, but could possibly benefit from having a better regulatory mechanism on, like, how much of that to whip out all at once with a partner.
Mm.
It's possible that she's just like, hey, this is who I am. This is what I'm into. And just doesn't know that you don't have to always do that one thing that you really are into every single time, all the time. These are conversations that, she could be having with her partner that, you know, that aren't happening. Maybe that's the kind of thing that Otis or whoever can facilitate going forward is, you know, hey, like this is something that you both can get on the same page about without having these sort of half conversations that end up being really hurtful to the other person.
It's funny how communication is something that really, really plays into a lot of the relationships in sex education, or lack of communication in a lot of cases, with Adam, who can barely communicate with anyone when they're looking at him, and you've got Lily, who's really struggling to explain to Ola what she really wants and how passionate she is about who she is. So yeah, I think communication is something that is quite difficult to these characters, and it's difficult to any teenager. I mean, we were all teenagers. We know how hard it was to talk to people and open up, because we just shut ourselves off and just be angry and hateful at everything and everyone at some point.
Yeah. For all kinds of reasons. Yeah. Like Adam has the words that he wants to express, but he can't.
Yeah.
At least not without intervening in some way, like looking away from the person or whatever. But he's got his struggles with communication. Everyone has their own reasons for why communication is difficult with sometimes very specific people or sometimes more generally.
Yeah, and inferiority as well, I think, is something that Adam really suffers with. I mean, he keeps calling himself stupid. Well, I'm stupid anyway. The scenes with the school teacher, I forget her name, are really, really lovely scenes where, you know, she's trying to encourage him. He's trying his best to get up to a higher grade in school, and he's so frustrated with himself because he can't get there. He's got a big inferiority complex, particularly when it comes to Raheem, who can write poetry. So he sees that as a threat earlier on, a huge threat, and that becomes a contention between him and Eric early on in the season. So it's all these things that teenagers and adults as well get. You know, these themes and emotions that sexual education deals with are very universal, and I think it's because why someone like me, who's a 40 something, can enjoy this TV show, because it's not, you know, even though we're in a school setting, it's human emotions are universal to a teenager or to an older person. So it's a great accessible way of telling stories, and I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And older audience members have an older relationship, or a couple of older relationships, to also latch on to when they're watching the series. We haven't even talked about Gillian Anderson yet, who's fabulous. Oh, she is phenomenal. She's phenomenal at everything she ever does. She's wonderful in this show, and she continues to have this relationship with this man, Jakob, who they began this sort of relationship in season two, broke things off, and she is pregnant with what she believes to be Jakob's child.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the season begins. And then at the end of the season, we are given the very strong impression that that is not in fact the case.
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. And in all likelihood, because of what happened in season two, in all likelihood, I think it's going to be Remy's. It's going to be her ex-husband, because they had that little, they both felt a bit frisky, and they ended up having sex, and that's when later on Jakob finds the cufflink. So that's when his suspicions start arriving. Man, you know, as much as the relationship,
because correct me if I'm wrong, she didn't tell him about that part,
no,
right?
Didn't she hasn't told him
yeah
about
she did
that.
Not
yeah
yeah yeah yeah, yeah.
And which in context of the scene when he's talking about how he doesn't trust her because of her past promiscuity, her face when he says that, because she hasn't told him that she had a fling with Remy, is quite revealing as well. So yeah, I mean, you know, as much as the kids at school have messy relationships, the adults have even messier relationships. We're almost worse at telling the truth to each other and telling the truth to ourselves than we are as the kids at Moreland School. So it's interesting that the adult relationships are as messy and fucked up as the kids at school.
Yeah, and you know, Jakob's, you know, presented as, I think, a type of person who is recognizable, but also sometimes a little hard to relate to, because he has, you know, some old-fashioned ideas about relationships and about communication and about therapy. And there are some things that he has in his own personality that, you know, sort of hold him back from being the best partner that he can be. But also, some of the things that he calls her out on, he's not wrong. Mm. Technically speaking, you know, when he says, "I don't trust you," like, you know, watching it as an audience member who cares about her character, that you think, "Ugh, that is rough. That is hard for her to hear. Like, I sympathize for her." But also, oh right, the reason he found that cufflink in the bedroom is because you did do this thing that you were lying to him about not doing. So he's not wrong.
No.
And it's this very complicated, messy situation, like you said. You know, we want Jean to be honest about the situation, but now it's additionally complicated by the fact that she has now gone out of her way to extremes to draw this man back into her life under the assumption that he is the father of her soon-to-be child. And now what does she do?
It's interesting because they are very aware that they want this baby to grow up in a family unit, which is why they try their best to move in as a family unit to support the baby, to, you know, and also support Otis and Ola. Otis is having a very hard time. He's an only child, so he's used to having the house to himself. It's his fortress. It's his place of safety and being himself. And now he's having to share the space with Ola, who has no qualms about nicking his records, which is criminal, if you ask me, because if anyone did that to my music collection, there'd be words said. So I understand. I understand where Otis is coming from there. So there's a lot of messy stuff that they're having to deal with within this family unit that they're trying to build, and it's kind of doomed to fail because neither Jakob or Jean are being completely honest with each. And I was thinking about it just now that all the older white males in this show are quite broken men, because you've got Jakob who lost his first wife, and I believe he's probably still in grieving in some sense. You've got Mr. Groff who is a very broken man now. You know, he's lost his marriage. He's dealing with his abusive brother. So I find it interesting that the adult males in this show are very broken men. They're not your typical kind of alpha male strong types. And I appreciate that Sex Education is going that way with these men.
No, the only other straight white adult that we get is that teacher, who is definitely not your sort of typical alpha male presentation of traditional masculinity that we're used to seeing on screen.
Yeah, it's very refreshing. Again, really refreshing that they could do this. And I think, you know, a lot of this is also down to streaming. I think streaming has allowed television to explore these things much more and allowed much, much more women writers and women directors. The showrunner of Sex Education is a woman, so it's allowing these different perspectives to flow through, and it's making for a very, very refreshing and very vibrant era of television at the minute.
Yeah, we don't need all our protagonists to be square-jawed douchebags.
Yeah.
I think I said before that we had one more relationship to talk about, but I completely overlooked one of the other wonderful relationship dynamics that we were introduced to in this season, which was Jackson and Cal, one of our newer characters. And their sort of disruption of the kind of traditional gender normative dynamics that had been in play for the first two seasons, they kind of cannonball into the pool of this school and immediately start to kind of shake things up, especially for Jackson, who is coming off a couple of seasons of a lot of pressure put on him, being, you know, this star athlete, this academic star, you know, the star of the school, basically. He was head boy. He had all of the, you know, accolades that you could want, all the sort of pressure on his shoulders that he didn't want. And at the beginning of this season, he's introduced to this new character, Cal, who does not, you know, identify on the gender binary, and immediately a lot of his assumptions about himself and his ideas about masculinity and heterosexuality are challenged by this character in a really interesting way. And it doesn't go the way that I was, I think, hoping, that I think a lot of audience members were probably hoping. I think all of us kind of root for the relationships that are introduced in this show. We're all kind of like, oh yeah, I'd like for this to work out. This seems nice, especially since they seemed to have a pretty good one. But he has some barriers in his mind that prevent that from moving forward, which are as understandable as they are unfortunate, I guess.
Yeah, this is a great storyline, and I really enjoyed watching Jackson's character change over these three seasons. And yeah, like you said, he's had all these pressures. We are reminded, I think, in the first or second episode that he gets a little dizzy and faint-headed, that he has these anxieties and stresses, this after-effect of being pressured by his two mothers to be this superstar athlete. And now he is allowing himself to relax a bit more, to be himself and do what he wants a bit more. And the character of Cal allows him to experiment with other people and experiment with drugs and just kind of have a good time, which he's not been allowed to do at school because of the pressures of being head boy and the pressures of being an athlete. So he's actually allowing himself to enjoy people's company and enjoy himself. And the relationship that he has with Cal is really interesting. Cal is, you know, they're not quite comfortable with the physical relationship. He is treating them as a girl in somewhat when they're getting intimate. That acts as a barrier, you know, for them both. And, you know, it's something that Jackson has to kind of contend with and get used to and allow himself to be comfortable with as well as Cal. So it's there's a really interesting dynamic here. And it's dealing with issues that I myself haven't really thought about because, you know, I'm a straight white male, so I love seeing this stuff on TV, and I love seeing these issues talked about because it's, you know, excuse the pun, it's educating to me because I don't know much about this, so it's really refreshing to see. And I think the writers have dealt with it in a very good way. I did seek out a short interview with Dewa, who plays Cal, and they said that they had a really special experience bringing a character to life on TV that identifies with them, and they thought that the writers were very well versed and very thoughtful. So that's an indication that the writers are doing the right thing, they're going in the right direction. So yeah, I found it a very, again, very refreshing and very interesting relationship to see evolve.
It was treated thoughtfully, I felt. I mean, again, I realize that I'm like yourself, coming at it from a perspective that isn't the same as Cal's or anyone who identifies with them. So I can only hope that the members of the audience who do identify with Cal feel like it was, you know, handled as well as I felt like it was handled. But I'd love for them to continue to explore some of that in season four. I thought you know, it was a wonderful sort of empathy exercise to sort of put yourself in the situation that Jackson found himself in and say, you know, how would I respond to a situation like that? Like, I'd like to think that saying I'm in a queer relationship wouldn't be a boundary that wouldn't even be a boundary to me, you know, wouldn't be something I would even have to get over. But I don't know. I haven't had to be in that situation before. I felt like while I didn't personally understand what his problem was, I understood that he likely represented a very real response that a lot of people would have. And I could also understand his reaction from that point of view. Like, it might not be the reaction that I would like to have or think that I would have in that situation, but it's certainly one that I can imagine a person having, even with the best intentions. You feel how you feel.
Yeah, it's you know, we as viewers react to this show emotionally, as you know, and the characters react emotionally as well. So you know, we can be analytical and talk about the themes as, you know, as we have, but we also react at a base emotional level as well. And you know, when Jackson is finding that a barrier, I understand what why he is. I think from a straight male's point of view, I understand why he feels it's a barrier. So it is something that he needs to look inside himself to kind of see, because he clearly likes,
yeah,
you know, he likes them very much.
And I think what I want to see out of season four is for him to continue, yeah, to explore, like, you know, he wasn't able to talk to his mom about that. Mm. Like, for him to maybe circle around to, you know, what would a conversation about that be like? You know, why is labeling that relationship as a queer relationship the barrier that he won't pass? It felt like to me watching it as that seems like a relatively small barrier to overcome for someone who you really feel like, it seems like you have a real connection with, like, yeah, you know, you were fine kissing them. Those were, you know, if those were queer makeout sessions, then going on a queer date shouldn't seem like it's such a additional barrier to get past. But he's a character who has his own complex set of emotions going on, his own programming that he's experienced, and so he's doing the best he can, like a lot of these characters are.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned, I think, a couple of points that were drawbacks to the season for you. Was there anything else in particular that stood out to you as not working?
No, it was just the side plot with Hope that was the only thing, the only negative thing for me. I think everything else worked superbly. I think everything, you know, all the hits that were meant to hit for me, apart from that one. You know, thinking about it, maybe I should have given a 9 out of 10, because I think that side plot with Hope is just a markdown, not two. So I'll change my mind. I'm gonna go with my emotions and go, let's up it to 9 out of 10.
Fantastic. Well, then we are definitely on the same page about that. Yeah, and I think I'm on the same page as you, criticism-wise. You know, I mentioned the one other moment that kind of, you know, maybe pulled me out of the episode when it happened, even as effective as a moment as it was with that scene with Ruby. Yeah, like you said, the subplot just seemed, with Hope, just seemed like it was more about getting us a little bit, a few more sympathy points for her and setting up that final scene with Otis. But other than that, yeah, this series is really firing on all cylinders. Very, very happy with what they're doing. Very much looking forward to what they've got in season four. The season ended with the school apparently being closed. So we're sort of going into unknown territory here. I don't really know what they're going to do, but I'm eager to see.
Yeah, yeah. And Maeve going off to America. So she's going off to her the talent school, I think, that she was going for. I can't remember exactly what it was, but yeah, she's off to America, so she's out of Otis's life for a period of time, at least.
Yeah, I wonder if we won't maybe get a time jump of some sort, maybe a year ahead, something like that, rather than just skipping a summer. We'll see. It'll be interesting. I really am excited to see these characters again, and I feel like if season three is any indication, then it's going to be great.
Yeah, definitely, absolutely. I mean, I do wonder. I think I had a very short conversation with Tony, our network chief, on Facebook, and we were talking about, you know, how long can Sex Education go for? Can they keep up the impetus of very, very strong writing, and how long they can go for? And, you know, he was saying maybe 5 years is a good round number to kind of close it off at the end. But I don't know how, you know, if they can keep doing these stories and keep writing these incredibly emotional, well-written, well-acted stories, then who knows, they can just keep going on for more seasons.
Yeah, they do keep the seasons short. You know, every time I start one, I'm always surprised and a little disappointed that it's only 8 episodes and not, you know, 10 or 13 like we might get from other shows on streaming. But I wouldn't be surprised if we get maybe one more after 4. But 4 could be a wrap-up season. I wouldn't be surprised with that either. But yeah, I tend to agree with Tony. I can't see it going past 5.
No, and I think, you know, the moment that Otis and Maeve get together and are both in love and are happy is where the series should end. Because I think, you know, as I mentioned, they are the axis that the show revolves around, and that's the central story.
Is that where you think it's going? Do you think that we're heading towards an eventual happy ending for these two with each other?
I think so. I think that's the natural place that this series could end, is those two together. And if I'm correct, I don't think that Maeve and Jean have shared a scene together yet.
Oh my goodness, is that true? I mean, I'm sure you're right, but yeah, that's wild.
Yeah. I could be wrong, and listeners can correct me, but I don't think they have. So I think what a great place to end would be Otis bringing Maeve home to introduce him to his mother. I think that would be a natural place for it to end.
I like that. Yeah, I like that idea. Well, unless you have any other thoughts you want to share, I think that that'll probably do it for our discussion. I think we had a pretty thorough one. There's even more we could have talked about, honestly. The show's got a lot going on in it, even though it is only 8 episodes. They are jam-packed with a lot of really good stuff, from the acting to the writing to the direction and the music, like we mentioned earlier. This show really has a lot going for it.
Yeah, it's one of those great times when a TV series has all these different components and they all just click at the right level, and they are, yeah, they're firing on all cylinders. The writing is top-notch. The acting is superb. There's a lot of really, really fantastic young actors, up-and-coming actors, that I'm sure are gonna lift their career off with this show.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. All right, well, thank you for joining me, Luke. It was a pleasure, as always. Do you want to plug any social media accounts, any projects you've got coming up, any other podcasts?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Ian. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you again. I think the last time we talked was on your Star Trek Discovery podcast. So
that sounds right. That sounds right.
Yeah. So my other podcast that I'm on, I host Observing the Pattern, which is a Fringe podcast. We are currently nearing the end of season 3 coverage. That's on at the minute. I currently co-host two Starship podcasts on the We Made This Network. One with Kurt North, which is Make It So, which is the Star Trek Picard. That's on a slight hiatus at the minute until we await the season 2 of Picard next year. So I'm looking forward to that. And I also co-host with Craig McKenzie, Ready Going, which covers Lower Decks and later on Prodigy. And you can find me on Twitter personally at Luke_Winch. I think that's about it at the minute.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I'm not really much on the social media, but you can definitely find me elsewhere on the We Made This Network. I am on We Are Starfleet, our Star Trek Discovery podcast. I pop up as a guest host on Rarely Going sometimes. I'm also on our Real Talk podcast, as well as a couple of other podcasts here and there. You will hear me around the network for sure. Thanks for joining us for another episode. And remember, we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network. Please subscribe to Scheduled Programming and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you'd like to help out our network financially, please consider supporting us on Patreon if you go to patreon.com/wemadethis. Sex education is not all we'll be discussing, so we are going to give you a taste of what you might have missed elsewhere on the network in just a moment. We'll be back soon to schedule more programming, so until then, do not adjust your set.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Observing the Pattern, a Fringe podcast.
Maybe people weren't quite ready for it. Maybe they wanted a bit more of what The X-Files was, which was a much more of a kind of monster of the week, scare you, or this kind of myth arc, which had its emotion and certainly had its strong themes of family as well. But I think Fringe had it much more to the fore, much more kind of focused through line for it.
And, you know, Luke, that's a really good observation in terms of, you know, like why it didn't catch on as much, because I do remember these conversations when it was airing live. And I want to say it was season 3, 4, and 5 where the fans really like took to Twitter and was like, and were like, you know, please renew this show.
Chucky Vision.
I think it's the most graphic of the lot of them.
I think it's the context that was just surreal. I mean, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how I would react as a censor to this, because, you know, we see, like, as we keep saying, we see Chucky jack off, but we don't just see like his reactions. There is literally a close-up shot of him grabbing his dick.
Yeah, and you know, there's a fucking turkey baster dripping with jizz.
Oh my god!
How the actual fuck is this a 15?
Well, I think if you make something cartoonish enough, then you will get away with it.
And it does feel like they got away with it.
Rarely Going, an animated Star Trek podcast.
To me, the one thing that keeps coming up in these episodes is Boimler is actually a really good leader.
Mm.
And he's got he actually earned his place on the Titan. Like, you know, it was kind of made of a joke. His transporter clone ended up getting to stay on the Titan, and he got sent back to the Cerritos and even got demoted when he did that. But, you know, time and again in each episode this season, Boimler has proven that he has what it takes to be a good leader. He has what it takes to be a command officer. I think that...
Absolutely.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.